Support for Science Friday's podcast comes from Squarespace, the award-winning website builder that helps you share your story with the world. Start a free trial at squarespace.com/Friday. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Cybersecurity is all over the news. This week, President Obama has been pushing for new cybersecurity legislation, more information sharing between the private sector and government. Companies would have to tell customers their information was stolen within 30 days of a security breach. But on Monday, as he spoke about beefing up U.S. cybersecurity laws and infrastructure, the Twitter and YouTube accounts of the U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, were hacked. And just yesterday came reports that there have been 19,000 cyber attacks targeting French websites. You know, the term hack gets thrown around quite a bit these days, but not all hacks are the same or equally severe. And how is the fear of being hacked going to shape cybersecurity policy? Molly Sauter is author of the book The Coming Swarm. She's also a research affiliate at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and MIT's Center for Civic Media. She joins us today from Northwestern University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Do you think hack is a term that gets thrown around too much?
Oh, yes. It essentially has no solid meaning at this point. You use the word hack to talk about a cool thing that you did. You use the word hack to talk about a Silicon Valley startup. You talk about civic hacking is a term that this administration likes to use a lot. And then, of course, you can always go back to it as the scary villain inside the intertubes who's going to come and steal all of your internet things. So it's a meaningless term at this point.
It actually started out as a positive term, if I remember back in the day in the early 80s.
That has been part of its context. There have been multiple attempts to sort of reappropriate the term from its use as a criminal modifier. However, I think right now it's still primarily used as a big, scary boogeyman in the internet.
Is the takeover of CENTCOM's Twitter and YouTube accounts an actual hack? How did that occur? Was that something that required really special knowledge about how to do that?
No. So despite the fact that this was a Twitter account run by CENTCOM, it's still a Twitter account. It's still relying on civilian infrastructure. It's still relying on whatever security practices Twitter had in place for that account. An interesting fact is that account wasn't verified. It didn't have that little blue check mark next to it, indicating that certain steps had been taken by Twitter and the people running the account to sort of verify that they were who they said they were. So they didn't even have the added security benefits that having a verified account gives you. So this wasn't a big, scary hack. This wasn't a particularly difficult hack. They probably just had a really weak password.
And no two-factor authentication, probably.
And no two-factor authentication. So though it's been used by President Obama and by other people who are pushing this very specific cybersecurity legislative agenda, it's not a particularly threatening action, and it's mostly just embarrassing.
Even if no confidential information was revealed, doesn't this send a message about how cutting-edge U.S. cybersecurity is or is not?
It mostly sends a message that while the U.S. government is eager to use these extremely popular platforms in order to make an effort of sending their message out to more people and in sort of more quote-unquote innovative ways, they're also heavily reliant on the security infrastructure that the civilian world uses, which perhaps says more scary things about how we, the civilian population, are forced into these poor security situations than anything else.
Mm-hmm. What about the infiltration of Sony Pictures' computer network? Was that an actual hack?
In so much as it involved information and knowledge about computer systems that the civilian population and most people don't have, yes, I guess you could consider it a hack. But the tools used in the Sony hack weren't particularly novel or innovative. These are tools that are available on the market. You can buy these malware suites and deploy them. You don't need to be developing these 0 days on your own anymore. So the question of whether or not it's a hack is sort of the wrong question. I think the question that should be being asked is, how difficult is it to put together something like the Sony Picture hack, and how likely is something like this to be deployed again? And what makes the Sony Picture hack interesting is not the quote-unquote novelty or innovation of the tools being used, but the fact that it was particularly targeted. We talk about all of these massive amounts of cyber attacks happening on the open web every day. What we're really talking about is crawlers that run around the open web and look for holes to get into. They look for things that are poorly defended. They look for sites that they can crack easily, but they're dumb spiders. The Sony hack was particularly targeted to Sony's systems, and that's what makes it more interesting.
Mm-hmm. And does that mean you're less vulnerable to, or not vulnerable, but you might be less of a candidate because you're not Sony?
Most people are not Sony, and therefore most people are not going to be targeted by this level of hack, yes.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that President Obama's proposal addresses this bot. I'm going to read you something from The Verge. It says, it will allow for the prosecution of people found to be selling or renting out the botnets and authorize courts to shut them down if criminal activity is detected. Is that that crawler you're talking about?
So botnets are often used to power things called DDoS actions or distributed denial of service actions, which is something that I've done a lot of research on in terms of how they're used for political activism. And while this legislative agenda does include language that would criminalize the use of botnets, it doesn't contain any language that would enable the Justice Department or prosecutors to differentiate between a DDoS action that's launched for a political activist purpose and a DDoS action that's launched to harass. And that I find troubling.
Tell me more about that.
So DDoS actions are just a tactic. They're a thing that can be used to make a point or make a criminal or take a criminal action, just like an occupation or a street march or a letter writing campaign. It's just a tactic that can be deployed to serve any number of actions. And we've often seen in history that these can be used for politically active purposes, to make a point about a politically active subject or to take an activist stance. And it's incredibly distressing when the government takes steps in order to criminalize actions and tactics without taking into account any reasonable amount of motivation. And we see this in prosecutions for civil disobedience, for instance. Often there is an understanding that civil disobedience can be undertaken for a political purpose, a politically valid purpose, or a politically invalid purpose. And there's an understanding built into the jurisprudence around civil disobedience to take that into account. But for computer-based actions that are civilly disobedient or disruptive but are also based in political activism, we often don't see that happening.
And you're worried that there will be no difference, and no one's making a difference between a destructive and a civil disobedient botnet.
This is true. It's true in most CFA or Computer Fraud and Abuse Act backed prosecutions. There's very little written into the law that allows a prosecutor to make a legal differentiation between a quote unquote computer crime and a political action that was disruptive that took place over a computer. Mm-hmm. And one really good example of this is the Aaron Swartz case from a couple of years ago.
Hmm. How could something like the compromise of CENTCOM's Twitter account influence cybersecurity policy?
It just enables the government and the Justice Department to stoke paranoia. As I mentioned before, Obama cited both the Sony hack and the CENTCOM Twitter hack in the same breath in his announcement of this legislative agenda, thus equating these two actions to the same level of threat, despite the fact that they are wildly divergent and one is mostly embarrassing and one is actually worth worrying about.
Mm-hmm. So what type of hacks should we be worried about?
The targeted nature of the Sony hack makes it interesting and something to be worried about if you are a corporation that deals with massive amounts of information and has as poor internal security structures as Sony appeared to have. But this is also part of a tradition that we've seen these targeted worms and bugs go out on the open net that are seeking out specific targets, but using the platform of the civilian net in order to get to them. And one thing that concerns me is the use of cyber weapons, quote unquote cyber weapons, or these programs and malicious bugs that are deployed by governments to attack state enemies that are often other states, but they use the civilian internet and the civilian infrastructure to get to those targets. And that I find to be an inappropriate use of the civilian internet, an attempt to make the civilian internet into a war of zone fight, a zone of war fighting. And that's something that needs to be examined in much greater detail than it currently is.
Oh, you mean, so cyber warfare is on a public battleground instead of on its own battleground, is what you're saying?
Exactly.
But what about the hacks that the security breaches, Home Depot, Target, Sony? Those things are legitimate things to be worried about.
Those are definitely legitimate things to be worried about, but I'm not entirely sure how useful it is for sort of your everyday person to worry about them, because there's really not much you can do about it. You can be sure to always use credit cards when you go and shop at a big box store, because you're more likely to not be held liable for purchases not made by you on a credit card than your debit card, for instance. But aside from these sort of habits of personal security, you can't do anything about Home Depot having poor security or Target having poor security on their databases. And so while it's becoming sort of this societal level of paranoia, there's not much that can be done at the level of the individual shopper to protect oneself against these things.
Or at least to be told that your company has been hacked, where you use your credit card.
Yeah, so that's another interesting thing about the president's new legislative agenda, was that he introduced these data breach regulations, or the concept of these federal data breach regulations. And though that sounds like a great thing, these are actually far weaker than the data breach regulations that most states already have in place. For instance, California, so we hear about data breaches now essentially because of California. California has a number of laws that say, for instance, if 500 or more consumer records are breached, that the company must inform the California Attorney General.
Okay, Molly, I have to interrupt you because we've run out of time, but we'll get back to this. No, you haven't done anything wrong. As they say, the clock on the wall. Thank you, Molly, for taking the time to be with us today. Molly Sauter is author of the book, The Coming Swarm. She's also a research affiliate at Harvard and at MIT. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about speech synthesis, making your computer sound more human. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You're probably familiar with the synthesized voice of Stephen Hawking.
I believe there are no questions that science can answer about the physical universe.
And I'm sure you've heard your smartphone talk too. But scientists have been trying to replicate the human voice since long before either of those computerized voices came out. All the way back to the 1700s with Wolfgang von Kempelen's voice synthesizer, a contraption that's sort of like a musical instrument. Here's how a replica of it sounds. And then the legendary Bell Labs got involved in the 1930s with their Voder, or Voice Operation Demonstrator.
For example, Helen, will you have the voter say, "She saw me"?
She saw me.
That sounded awfully flat. How about a little expression? Say the sentence in answer to these questions. Who saw you?
She saw me.
Whom did she see?
She saw me.
Well, did she see you or hear you?
She saw me.
Then in 1978 came Speak and Spell.
Now spell angel.
Not quite Siri, right? But you can see the direction. We're going to get into how modern synthesized voices are made. But first, Brad Story is here to fill us in on more of the history and why he's modeling the human vocal tract today. Brad Story is a professor in the Department of Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He joins us from KUAZ. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Story.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I was surprised to learn how far back people first got interested in simulating speech.
Yeah, the desire to do this goes back centuries, as you mentioned in your intro, and I think that almost the modern aspect of speech synthesis began with the famous mathematician and physicist Leonard Euler. He wrote back in 1761 that something to the effect that without a doubt the developing a speaking machine that would replicate the articulations of human speech would be one of the great achievements of science. And he, even at that point, his interest in it was that he thought it could become an augmentative communication device. He saw people who were speech impaired who could no longer give their talks or talk to in conversation, and he saw this as a possible means of alleviating those communication impairments. And then he actually developed devised a contest for people to develop a speaking machine when he was at St. Petersburg. And a man named Kratzenstein won that contest by creating what amounted to little tiny organ pipes that would replicate human vowel sounds. But, of course, that didn't talk. It just produced some vowel sounds. And then along came von Kempelen, who spent about 20 years developing this mechanical device that was really a simulation of human speech. It included a bellows to simulate the respiratory system. It drove that air pressure to vibrate some reeds, which produced a buzz-like sound that was then coupled to some acoustic cavities that could be modified in shape. In fact, the way he used it was a pliable leather tube that he would manipulate with his hand to produce that kind of sound that you played in the segment. Mm-hmm. That led to, in the early 1800s, another man developing a mechanical speaking device, a man named Joseph Faber, who kind of based his idea on von Kempelen's, but made it much more complicated, complex, but easier to use to produce speech. And it involved the same kind of bellows arrangement with a reed to excite some air cavities, but the user could actually manipulate all of these things with a keyboard, so you'd have the finger control plus a foot pedal. And this supposedly, we don't have any, nobody's ever actually built a replica of that I'm aware of, but the reports of it were that highly intelligible speech could be produced. One of the interesting aspects of it, though, was that Faber was German, and he was demonstrating this to an English audience, and the synthesizer had a German accent. And there's nothing German about the device itself. It was the movements of his hands and his feet based on his own speaking patterns that were imposed on his speaking device. And had somebody else with a different native language background used that device, it would have taken on characteristics that they had. That was a precursor to the voter that you also mentioned in the introduction. In fact, it was the operation of this mechanical device was very much like the voter. The difference with the voter, of course, is that everything was done electronically, and that was the first time that we had a speech synthesizer that was dealt with in the electronic realm. Mm-hmm. And that was really quite a remarkable achievement, and was demonstrated at the 1939 World's Fair with quite a bit of fanfare.
What was the impetus about? Was there, you know, some money to be made in inventing these things, or pure research?
Well, that is a very good question. It's always the question of why. In fact, von Kempelen wrote extensively about building his machine, and he addressed that question, and he even made a comment, "Sometimes I'm not sure why I'm doing this, other than to prove that it can be done." But I think it's understanding how humans transform language or linguistic concepts at a cognitive level into a highly complicated, highly complex sound wave that transmits all of that information through an auditory system and back up into our brain. I think that's just a mystery that humans have always wanted mm-hmm. to solve.
Now, I know you are involved in trying to mimic the human voice. Tell us about your research.
So my research is really, it falls into a type of category of speech synthesis, but sometimes we refer to it as speech simulation. And that is because we are attempting to some degree, recreate the actual system that humans use to produce speech sounds. So what that means is we are computationally modeling the vibration of the vocal folds, which is the primary source of sound. Now, alone, that sounds a bit like a buzzer, but when that's coupled to the airways of the pharynx, or we might call the throat and the mouth, the throat and the mouth becomes what we call an acoustic filter. And that acoustic filter then enhances or suppresses certain parts of the frequency spectrum depending on the shape of the airspace. So that's our approach to it. Now, that is an approach that doesn't necessarily lend itself to typing in a word on a keyboard and converting it into sound. Our purpose in using it is really as a research tool, is that we can make modifications or we can control aspects of the physiology and see what effect that does have on production of the sound. So our goal primarily at this point is using it as a research tool. The other part of that, though, is that it also produces sound, and that sound can be used as stimuli in perception experiments. And so you can have listeners responding to characteristics of the sound that that may be related to some physiologic aspect of the speech production system.
Mm-hmm. Well, we want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us today and that filling us in on some of the fascinating history.
You're welcome.
Brad Story is professor in the Department of Speech, Language, and Hearing Sciences at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He was talking to us from KUAZ. As we talk more about smart devices, we naturally expect them to talk back to us, and that's where the cutting edge of artificial voice technology is heading. Can we make a machine sound more human? Can we make it laugh? And so well that we believe the laughter, or hear the emotion or melody in a synthesized voice? Might we even be able to fall in love with these synthetic voices in the future, as Joaquin Phoenix did in the movie Her? Alan Black is a professor of language technologies at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. He joins us from WESA today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's nice to be here.
Thank you. Rupal Patel is founder of Vocal ID, a company that builds personalized synthetic voices. She's also a professor of communication sciences and disorders and computer information science at Northeastern University in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Alan, building on what Brad was talking about, how do we get to modern day speech synthesis? Bring us up to date.
So Brad gave a very interesting background of really the technologies that were being built up into, say, the 50s and 60s, where computer technology really began to take off. The Stephen Hawking example that you played earlier is still using pretty low-level technology. It is understandable, but it's very robotic in what it actually sounds like. Once we got into the 80s and 90s, we realized that the thing that would make it most human-like is to actually use human speech. So we would use recordings of human speech and take small subword units of them and put them together, and hopefully you don't hear the joins, and you end up with something that can construct new speech that has never been in the original recordings. And most of the commercial synthesizers, like you see in Siri and Amazon Echo these days, are actually of that form called unit selection, where they're basically taking subword units from large databases of carefully pre-recorded speech.
Mm-hmm. And Rupal Patel, you actually take this a step further in your research. You're trying to actually build personalized voices for people who can't speak by combining real voice samples. Tell us how that works.
That's right. So the problem is a little bit different in our case, because we don't necessarily have a lot of speech from someone who may have a need for a speech synthesizer. So they're using it as their main device, like someone like Professor Hawking. But he's still able to make some vocalization, and that vocalization carries the essence of who he is in terms of his voice. And so what we do is we have a speech donor about the same size and the same age and the gender of the individual. And that donor produces the library of speech sounds like Alan was talking about. And then we take whatever vocalization the individual can still make, the recipient can still make, and we blend those two samples together to create a composite recording, and then use the same kinds of technologies to sort of be able to reconstruct speech.
Let's give people an idea of what you're talking about. We have a clip of two different voices you created using the same basic donor voice. Let's hear that.
My grandfather. You wish to know all about my grandfather. Well, he is nearly 93 years old.
My grandfather. You wish to know all about my grandfather. Well, he is nearly 93 years old.
Wow. Sounds pretty good.
Thank you.
How, are people actually using this now?
We do have 3 beta users who are using those voices. And in fact, 2 of them are the ones you just heard. And now we've started a company sort of roll out this technology from the laboratory where we demonstrated proof of concept to scaling it making it available to individuals.
If I heard it correctly, the 2 clips had a sort of difference in the pitch of the voice. Why? What was the point there?
That's because each of those individuals has a slightly different voice. And so one of the girls has a higher pitch sound. So when she produced her sample for us, it had a higher pitch to it. And when you infuse that into the vocalizations of the donor, you get that. So the essence of that resultant voice is a combination of the donor and the recipient who's going to receive that voice. It sounds more like her.
Yeah. I'm Ira Flater. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Alan Black and Rupal Patel. Alan, how important is it to have a voice that's personalized to the task at hand, helping people on the phone versus, you know, a flight announcing system where they put all those little pieces together?
So it's actually quite important. The listener has got judging and expectations of how it actually sounds. I remember years ago we built a flight information system from a Boston University radio announcer. And when we built the system, it was fine. It was very understandable. But instead of sounding like a flight announcement system, which was very clear and very articulate, it sounded like a news reporter saying, "Where are you flying today?" rather than actually, you know, giving you the information. And so there's lots of subtle things that are in the speech that are actually very important to interpretation. And even when we're recording things, we have to make sure that the person recording it understands what it's going to be used for and has that view when they're actually recording it.
Well, you know, people, certainly myself included, we stumble a lot when we talk. We don't have that sort of radio voice. Do you put that in to make it sound more realistic?
So that's actually an interesting thing. We've even got interesting new research going on about that. You know, when you're in a conversation, it's actually quite important to do the false starts, to do the ums and ahs. When you first speak, often we'll put in "well" or "so" at the beginning, which is a way for the listener to get used to the fact that you're now going to give something interesting or you want to get the floor. And most speech synthesizers actually don't do that. So at the moment, they're very clear, they're very understandable, but they're like pre-recorded speech. They don't engage you in the conversation, but they pass the information over.
Rupal, can you program sarcasm or nuances? You know, when you talk, you sort of smile sometimes. You can hear it. Can you do that?
We don't do that, but I think that I think that is something that we want to have because, again, going back to this idea of what's the contextual scenario and how the voice is being used, right? So if you smile, we know that when people are smiling that it changes the acoustics of their speech, and we'd love to be able to actually do that in modern-day synthesis. I think the more we understand about what we do with natural speech and communication, the better or the more we're going to be able to approximate that in our tools.
Well, real voices are full of flaws. You have the creaky sounds, the breathy sounds. I do all this kind of stuff all the time. Is it the aim to build those realistic-sounding flaws into the machines? Rupal?
And into the machine. So in terms of, in our case, we're trying to make it sound like the individual using it. In other words, what is the pitch of that individual? Do they have a breathy sounding voice? Not so much what you're talking about is in terms of sort of how are they using it? Because in our case, our users are usually typing and then talking, right? So their device is talking out loud for them. There is a whole other layer of that communication back and forth that we'd also like to include in it, but that's something sort of, I think, later in the future.
Can you get it too well? I mean, is the idea to, you know, can you have an Alan Turing test of a voice, whether it's a real person talking to you or not?
I think that maybe that's the wrong goal in some sense, because when things are too good or too smooth, They don't seem believable. Just like you said earlier, you have ums, you have flaws. I hesitated earlier when I was speaking. That's what makes us human. And the more and more we try to perfect only one aspect of this, and that's kind of, I think, what we've been doing in the research and development of synthesis, is focusing on the speech sound clarity. Mm. How is that really the goal?
Yeah. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk lots more with Alan Black and Rupal Patel. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It would be a Irish marriage. I had the horse to carry. But you look sweet upon the feet of a bicycle built.
Hey, podcast listeners. Take a look around. Chances are, if there's something stunning, you'll stop and stare at it for a while. That's the power of Squarespace, a sponsor of today's podcast. Its platform is easy yet powerful, so you get superior engineering and high functionality when you want it. Everything is mobile responsive, so your website looks elegant in any size window. And because you're a Sci-Fi listener, you can try it for free at squarespace.com/Friday. You're listening to Science Friday. In case you just joined us, we're talking this hour about synthetic speech, how it's made, and we can make it a little more human, with my guests, Alan Black, professor of language technologies at Carnegie Mellon University, Rupal Patel, founder of Vocal ID. She's also a professor at Northeastern University in Boston. In the few minutes left, I'm going to give both of you my blank check question. You have all the money in the world. You can write a blank check. You need to spend it on something in your line of work. Alan, first, what would you spend it on? What do you need?
I think that's an excellent question, which I wasn't ready for. Let's go ahead and try.
Well, you're not
and
getting the money anyhow. So what's the
difference? Right. Well, wait. I think the answer is, you know, we're already getting used to being able to talk to devices. We get to see Siri, Microsoft Cortana, and people are becoming more comfortable with the idea that their machines are actually speaking. But it's still the case that they're not engaging a conversation. And I think what we'd like to see is much more personalization. So that it can sound like people and so you get a choice. I'd like to see much more customization in it so we actually have it doing adaptation so that when somebody's speaking casually, the replies are casual. When somebody's speaking more formally, the replies are formal. So I would actually be looking at collecting more conversational speech and study how to do speech synthesis within a conversational setting rather than just passing information through synthetic speech.
It's interesting you mention that because when we speak, I'm going, yeah, I understand you. I repeat your question. We don't hear any of that.
That's absolutely true. Back channeling is incredibly important. In some languages, it's even critical to communication. So in Japanese, it is necessary to actually do back channeling, so saying things like hi and so des when you're actually talking in Japanese. And if you don't do that, the person just assumes that you can't hear and that you can't understand what's going on. In English, it's sort of required, but it's not absolutely necessary. Hmm. But it's something that our machines should do if they are understanding us, being able to give appropriate feedback like that.
I learned a new phrase today, back channeling. Stop back channeling, Ira. You're interrupting the guest. Rupal, what would you use your blank check on?
Well, I'd first use my blank check to fund our company. That's, but I think seriously, I agree with Alan. I think conversational speech is certainly something that we need a lot more of so that we can model it more appropriately in our devices. I also think that the focus really needs to be on the melody and the prosody of speech because we focus so much in synthesis on getting the speech sound clarity right, the intelligibility. But it's the message is a lot more than just the words. It's also how it's said. And that conveys so much of the meaning as well as the intention of what we're saying. So I think the focus being on melody, which is kind of what we're doing with banking voices. So we've created this initiative called the Human Voice Bank Initiative to gather lots and lots of speech from donors all over the world. We hope that we can get a million donors so that we can create these unique voices for those who need them. And perhaps even for our devices so that they sound more representative of who we are and the fabric of really the diversity in voice that we have.
Alan, last question to you, because as we get better languages and synthetic voices are better, are people going to be more or less polite to the computers, you know, depending on how realistic the computer's voice sounds?
I think the answer will be yes. We have already got evidence of this. We ran some experiments on a dialogue system here in Pittsburgh about bus information, and we were running some different systems, and one of the systems came from Cambridge, UK, and used a British English accent, Southern British English, not Scottish like mine. And what we discovered was that the Pittsburgh people were much more polite to it than what they were to our standard American voices, because, as we know, we should be polite to the Brits for some reason. And so the answer is, people will reflect the style or the register or how they're being communicated. If it's being polite and formal, people are likely to do that. If it's being casual and colloquial, they're likely to do that. So the answer will be, we will adapt, and the machines will adapt too. They will try to build rapport. This, in some cases, will be a good thing. And, you know, it's better for education. It's better for building trust. But of course, in the same way, it also has bad things, because it's better for, you know, giving us ads, telling us political things that we might not believe in. And so you have to be careful about that. But the technology is going to improve so that it will be more friendly, and you won't notice it is becoming more friendly.
Well, we're glad the Pittsburgh folks were nice to you, especially WESA. We really appreciate that. They were nice to you, Alan. That's about all the time we have. Alan Black is professor of language technologies at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Rupal Patel is founder of Vocal ID. She's also a professor of communication sciences and disorders and computer information science at Northeastern University in Boston. Have a great weekend. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you.
You've all been waiting for it, so let's convene this season's Science Friday Book Club. That's where we ask you to read a science book with us, and we get together a few weeks later to talk about it. They're like a real book club. Last summer, the book club wandered the sands of the planet Arrakis looking for sandworms. We read Frank Herbert's sci-fi classic Dune. Well, this time, we're going in just the opposite direction. We're searching for lost cities, well, not very arid place. Our SciArts producer, Annie Minhoff, joins us to talk about the new book and introduce us to it. Annie, welcome back.
Thank you, Ira.
Where are we going?
Well, we are going to the heart of the Amazon. Last time we went the fiction route. This time we're going the nonfiction route. Though some things in this book are so surprising, you might just find yourself thinking, could this really have happened? But it did. We're reading David Grand's epic story of South American exploration, The Lost City of Z, a tale of deadly obsession in the Amazon. And everyone loves deadly obsession, right?
Bring that spooky music.
Yeah.
Wind in there. I have to admit, I read it already.
I know, you cheated a little bit.
I read a few pages. I thought I'd get a head start. I have a lot of reading to do. I couldn't put this book down.
Yeah.
I could not put this book down.
Me neither. I mean, I'll just give you a little taste of what this is about. So our story begins in 1925 with an explorer named Percy Fawcett. And he's really kind of the last in this long line of Victorian explorers who would go out and try to kind of fill in those blank spaces on the map. And Percy Fawcett did this all over the Amazon, heading out in these expeditions. But in 1925, he was out for something very specific. Mm-hmm. And he thought that he had irrefutable scientific evidence of a lost advanced civilization in the heart of the Amazon, which he called Z. And of course, where there's lost advanced civilizations, you have fabulous lost cities that if you're an explorer, of course, you have to go find it and gain fame and fortune. So that's what Fawcett was doing in 1925. And he heads into the forest and he never comes back out. So it's this giant mystery at the heart of exploration, which our intrepid author, David Gran, is out to solve. And, of course, inevitably ends up following Fawcett's footsteps into the Amazon.
It is really an adventure, because you learn not only is it just the will he or will he not find the city, but you learn what it's like to live in this jungle and how the jungle wants to eat you, basically.
It really does. In fact, one of the kind of things I appreciate about the book is we hear so much about, you know, the polar explorers. Like, you'd think, you know, the poles would be the most unforgiving landscape you could possibly encounter.
The Shackletons, people like that.
Right. And I think this book gives a lot of credit to the guys like Fawcett who are out in the Amazon and really shows us that, you know, that was no cakewalk either. In fact, David Grand tells an amazing story about an explorer named James Murray, who was one of these guys who had been to Antarctica with Shackleton. And thought, you know, it would be a cakewalk to go with Fawcett, you know, for a jaunt through the Amazon, and really is in for kind of a rude awakening.
Sure
So let's listen to what David Grand had to say about James Murray.
Murray, who was the name of this explorer, begins to discover that exploring in the Amazon could be a green hell. He's hungry. He gets sick. You know, a small cut in the Amazon could lead to gangrene quickly. What he got were these maggots that got into the skin and then would grow and poke their heads out. And his diary, as much as anything I'd ever read, gave you just a visceral sense of what it was like and the horror it could be like to explore in these areas.
That was just the beginning of what the horror is like.
So if you don't want to read the book after you've heard about the maggots growing in James Murray's arm, I don't know what's going to do it for you.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, these were Victorian era explorers. And being British, they had that stiff upper lip. And now we're talking about Fawcett himself.
Yes.
And I had never heard of him, actually, but he was so storied in the world of exploration.
In his day, every newspaper would carry the story of what Fawcett was up to. In fact, throughout his expedition until he gets lost, he's sending out these dispatches to go out in newspapers all over the world. It was advertised that Indian runners were taking these messages through the Amazon out to the newspapers. Incredibly storied. And this is how David Grand describes his subject, Percy Fawcett.
Fawcett really was a larger-than-life character. I mean, he was a man who was indomitable, fanatical, incredibly brave and courageous. He would take these small expeditions of only a few men, and they had a rule. He made all his men agree that when they came, that if one of them fell sick, which they commonly did or couldn't make it, that they would have to be abandoned because it would threaten the rest of the party to try to carry them out.
Hmm.
The only honorable thing would be to starve and to stay behind and not hold back the expedition as a whole. So if that's not stiff upper lip, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm. And we aren't reading this alone, are we?
No, we are not. So what's going to happen is we're all going to go out, we're going to read the book, and we're going to be back here on February 6th to talk about it with two very special readers we've recruited to kind of go on this Amazonian journey with us. And the first one of those readers is Sarah Parkak, and she calls herself a space archaeologist. And what that means is that she's using satellite imagery to look down on the sites that she's interested in Egypt, and really pinpoint very precisely where she's going to dig. So you can imagine that Fawcett would have kind of killed for this technology back then. But I asked Sarah Parkak why she was interested in reading this story with us.
As a modern day explorer and archaeologist, I am obsessed with finding ancient things. I'm curious, though, to learn what drove crazy explorers from over 100 years ago, and to learn what, if anything, we share in common. Technology has changed so much. The work I do with satellites allows us to find ancient cities from our labs thousands of miles away, but I don't think the passion for discovery has changed at all.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Here with Annie Minhoff, Science Friday arts producer, talking about our sci-fi book club selection.
That's right. So we're going to find out if Sarah Parkak and this guy Fawcett have anything in common. But the second reader who will be joining us on air on February 6th is a novelist and editor named Jeff Vandermeer. And his most recent series of books is called the Southern Reach Trilogy, which has some interesting parallels with Fawcett's story, because he's writing about a team of scientists, this is fiction, by the way, who are heading into this kind of secret wilderness called Area X. So we have an X and a Z. And encountering all kinds of just the weirdest, most threatening biology you can imagine, you know, springing from the mind of Jeff Vandermeer, and really exploring why do scientists do this? Why do they go out into the unknown? So I think Jeff will have some very interesting thoughts on Fawcett.
Mm-hmm. So what is the science, though, that's at stake in Z? What are we looking for here?
Right, because is this all just adventure for adventure's sake? Well, I think that the author of the book David Grand would say that the science, you know, the stakes there are nothing less than our understanding of the Americas before Columbus. Certainly to find a city like Z would rewrite a whole lot of history. But it also goes to the heart of this kind of question of, you know, are societies really restricted by their geography? The argument that a lot of scientists made back in Percy Fawcett's day was, of course, you couldn't have an advanced civilization in the Amazon because you can't have agriculture, you have mosquitoes spreading malaria and yellow fever.
There's no fertile ground.
You know, and just the craziest predators. It's just impossible. And so Fawcett was really flying in the face of all of that and was not very popular with the scientists of his day for proposing that actually, of course you could. And that evidence came from his interactions with the indigenous tribes who he met on his journeys. So I think that's what's at stake here for the science.
And in terms of civilizations, you come away from this book.
Oh, no spoilers.
No spoilers, with a whole different look of than when you entered the book, I think. You have a whole different, you're much more educated and thoughtful about what's going on or what could have gone on in South America.
I will say that there definitely is a big payoff at the end. So I think if you start the book, I mean, you're going to want to keep reading because there really is a mm-hmm. giant payoff at the end.
And we have some free books to give away, right?
We do. A big thank you to Powell's Books for a second time helping out our book club with donating 20 brand spanking new copies of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. We would like you listening to have a chance to get one of these free books sent to you for free. And the way that you do that is by going to sciencefriday.com. You'll see the icon for our book club in Lost City of Z. Click on that. There's going to be a form you fill out. If you're one of the first 20 people to do that, you're going to get one of these books.
And Powell's also discounting the book. If you're not one of the lucky 20,000.
If you're not lucky, there's this little extra incentive. It's on sale. So you can find that link on our website as well.
Just for knowing about it on Science Friday. You know, we've done book clubs before. We've challenged people to read new things. This book, you will not be sorry you're reading this book. This is a great book.
It's true. Agree? And I think Ira's just, you know, I can see it. You're just waiting for everyone else to read it so that you can talk about the end.
It's a book where science fact is stranger than fiction. It has Hollywood movie stars in the jungle there. It has all kinds of stuff.
I think every day at the office it's been sharing the next weird animal that's emerged in the Lost City of Z. Is it the fish that swims up the human urethra and blocks the flow and kills you? Or is it
the piranha that's going to get...
The piranha? Is it the bug that bites you on the lip and you die 2 years later? There's a lot of odd biology in this book.
Don't read this in the dark.
Yeah.
All right, Annie Minow, thanks for joining us
today. Absolutely.
So that's about all the time we have. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our producer is Annie Minow. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineers, spinning the dials here in the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again, point your tablet or smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com. That's where you'll find information about the book and how you might get a free copy of it. And if you like us, then like us on Facebook. And, of course, we're tweeting all week long with our tweet handle at SciFry, and you can download our iPhone and Android apps, and you can look and listen on demand, take it along with you. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.